And once again, we're back on Radio Liberty, 89.9 FM on your radio dial, KFER, broadcasting from the hills overlooking beautiful Monterey Bay. This is Dr. Stan. Our special guest this evening is Colonel Fetcher Prouty, who is the consultant for Oliver Stone's film JFK, which many of you have seen. Let me give you our telephone numbers because we're going to open them up. And actually right at this time, you'd like to speak to the Colonel. Make a comment. Our telephone number is 464-8295. We prefer that you just ask questions this evening. We'll open it up later this week for comments and other things that you want to say, but we'd prefer that you had a specific question for the Colonel. So let's see if somebody's on line one. Now, we lost line one, but we do have line two. Hello there. Is this Tony?
Yeah, hi, Dr. Stan.
Hi, how you doing, Tony?
Oh, pretty well. My question had to do with a man by the last name of Mars, who I think also had something to do with this as far as being assistant. And I heard him about 6 months ago on KGO, and he said that there was a particular document signed by Dulles, I forget which one, that actually ordered the assassination. I was wondering if the Colonel had any insight into this.
I know the gentleman to whom you refer. In fact, Jim Mars worked extensively with Oliver Stone, and his book was used as a basic source. I am not familiar with the document. You say that there was a document signed by Alan Dulles.
That's what this Mars fellow said. He said he actually had a copy of it.
Well, now, I don't know the context in which that came up. But, of course, Alan Dulles signed the Warren Commission report. He was a member of the Warren Commission. So this puts Alan Dulles in a rather unusual situation, which, if it's true, I think it'd be pretty remarkable. I'm not aware of that. I knew Mr. Dulles very well, and I have not heard of it.
Another question I had was, he also made a remark that LBJ's secretary walked in on LBJ when he got the call from the assassination, and LBJ's response was, "That SOB will never embarrass me again." And he seemed to think that LBJ was also implicated in this. I was wondering if you had any remark on that.
Well, I think the setting there is not exactly correct. Lyndon Johnson, then the vice president, was in a car, two cars behind the president, and he had no access to secretaries or whatever in that position. Now, on the way home from Dallas, after he had been sworn in as president of the United States, he received a call from the White House and was informed at that time that the White House thought that the assassination had been caused by one man, and you know the story from there on out. And a lot of people have wondered how it was that the White House was informing Johnson that one man named Lee Harvey Oswald killed the president when the police in Dallas themselves didn't know that at that same hour. In fact, that was a point we made in the movie, that I bought a newspaper in Christchurch, New Zealand, and of course communications is in real time, so there's no problem with that, but this newspaper in New Zealand carried a complete biographical story about Oswald, all kinds of details, and it was printed and available to people to purchase before Oswald had been arraigned for the crime, something that is, you know, it can't happen that way. So there were some very strange things going on at that time, and you've brought up another one. It's very interesting.
Tony, thanks so much for calling. I think the one thing we have to point out is there is a lot of intentional misinformation and disinformation that's being put out just to confuse the issue. Don't you feel that's true?
Yes.
All right, let's take...
See, that began early, because some of the things that were put out in the first minute after the crime were, today we just ignore them completely. One was that there were three bursts of automatic weapon fire. Now, CBS interrupted all their nationwide programs to give that information. Three bursts of automatic weapon fire.
I guess
that's not a single shot gun.
I guess they didn't have the official line at that point.
Yep.
Well, look, let's take our caller here on line four. Hello, are you with us?
Hello.
Hello, who's this?
This is Tom from Santa Cruz.
Oh, hi, Tom from Santa Cruz. How are you?
It's a great show.
Well, thank you.
I got a question for Colonel Prouty. Having been up in the inner workings of the government, who do you think's in charge of this whole thing? I mean, you hear people talk about the international bankers and the Rockefellers and the Rothschilds and Council of Foreign Relations, all these different groups. From your point of view, where did this? Who was in charge of this whole secret government?
You know, that question arises every single time we get together to talk, and I think it is a most important one, because in the book I quote Buckminster Fuller from his wonderful book called Critical Path. You should all read Critical Path by Buckminster Fuller, and he speaks of people, anonymous people of extreme power, great power, and of traditional power from way back, that he calls the power elite. And he explains it very carefully. In my book, I try to explain it by citing many people like that and some things in my own experience. But here's something that might interest you. Benjamin Disraeli, you know, was Prime Minister of England. And Disraeli said, "The world is governed by far different personages than what is imagined by those not behind the scenes." I take that from my experience of being a true statement. I've seen enough examples of it.
Could I comment for the listener who doesn't know where that quotation comes from? It comes from Disraeli's book called Coningsby. And for those of you who'd like to check it out, it's certainly there, just as the Colonel says. Tom, thank you so much for calling.
Thank you.
Okay.
All right.
And let's go to line one here. Hello?
Hello?
Who do we have?
Oh, hi. My name's Ben. I'm calling from Santa Cruz.
All right, Ben. Thank you so much for calling. And you have a question for the Colonel.
I have two questions. I've heard that, this is for the Colonel, I've heard that the Golden Triangle, or the Drug Triangle is what they call it, I guess, was set up primarily to finance the Black Op projects for the CIA, and I also heard that, this is my second question.
Well, just take one at a time, and then you can ask the second one.
Okay, I thought you guys were pressing for time here.
Dan, would you repeat that? There was a few words there that I didn't get.
He said that he'd heard that the Golden Triangle drug operation had been set up by the CIA to finance their paramilitary organizations that they couldn't get the funding for. In other words, they were running drugs to get money to finance CIA operations. Do you feel there's any truth in such a statement?
Well, I'll tell you, I worked to some extent with a man named Al McCoy, who wrote a book called The Politics of Heroin in Southeast Asia. I don't know a book on the subject that is better, even though that book now is probably 20 years old. And in that book, he gives a story of how some of the crews operating CIA's proprietary airline, which is a contract job and a huge airline, one of the biggest airlines in the world, were, without question, carrying drugs back and forth as they went on their way with CIA jobs. Now, whether that money went into CIA treasury or not, I don't know. But I do know, if you want to study the subject further, that CIA had a street name in Wall Street, and that which connotes the fact that they had a large account, and that at that time it was of an enormous volume of money, which was not public government money. The CIA had made that money in one way or another through its proprietaries and some of the things they were doing. And of course, a CIA agent was one of the men who founded and operated the Nugan-Hand Bank. And the Nugan-Hand Bank years ago was a billion-dollar bank. Mr. Nugan was killed in Australia, and we have not seen Mr. Hand since that time. And the bank just fell apart. $1 billion is a lot of money for a young man working for CIA to put together.
If I could just comment, there is another more modern book. It's called Kiss the Boys Goodbye by Monica and William Stevenson that covers much of the same background on the drug and the Golden Triangle, and, of course, the boys that were left behind in Laos. for political expediency, American prisoners who were simply abandoned. Ben, you had one more quick question.
Okay, and the next one will be, there's two parts.
Well, no, just one more. We've got the lines filled up
okay,
here.
Okay. And I also heard that the a large portion of that black op money went to this alien UFO research that the secret governments are trying to keep under wraps. If, in fact, it is real, it's probably, I've heard that it was old German technology that they've taken out of Petamunde or somewhere like that. Anyway.
Did you get the question, Colonel?
I'd like to have you repeat it. There's a little bit there. I can't hear the caller too well.
All right, let's turn you up here. Ben, just say it quickly again, would you please?
In regards to the black ops monies,
yes.
A large portion of that, I hear, was filtered down into the research of this alien UFO thing.
Well, I'll tell you now, people laugh at that.
All right.
But you take a little camping trip one day over in the eastern part of California up against the Nevada line, a place called Groom Lake, and just sit up in the hills there sometimes and just listen. And you'll hear some things that you've never heard before. Don't go too near the fence, because the fence is active. It's hot. But there are things going on. I think it's worth two or three other shows. But I don't know of the link-up that way. This program that's going on out at Groom Lake is pretty well funded by what they call black budget, and it'll go by itself.
All right, Ben, thanks so much. Please call again sometime. We have some fascinating programs in this next week.
Yes.
But thanks for being with us.
Okay, bye.
And who do we have here on line three?
Bill.
Bill, thank you for being with us.
Hi, that was me that mentioned the Southeast Asian politics last night on your program also.
Right. Okay, fine. Well, good to have you again.
The question I wanted to ask Mr. Prouty was about JFK when he attacked the Old Boy Network and wanting to do away with the monetary debt system and things like that, actually incurred the wrath of the Old Boy Network, which, if you know much about the Masonic organization, that's how they refer to themselves. I wonder if you could shed some light on that angle of this debate.
Well, Colonel, the question is, is there a Masonic element in this? Is this the military-industrial complex? How do you look upon this power elite that you speak of in your book?
Well, I'll tell you, this is something that has been studied by many people for a long, long time. And you can read books based exactly on what this man has said and on other power centers like that, some in competition with each other. I can just say, like, speaking from my own experience, what I've seen come up, and then you can kind of see how that fits into your ideas, because I don't think this is the place to really get into the fine points of your question. But I happened to be at the Cairo conference in 1943 that was between Churchill, Roosevelt, and Chiang Kai-shek. It was the first time Chiang Kai-shek had been brought onto the world scene as a major power. And then the minute that conference ended, the next day, we flew to Tehran, and there was a conference there, the Tehran conference, between Stalin, Roosevelt, and Churchill, and Chiang Kai-shek. But you won't find that in a single history book. Now, the reason I can say that with assurance is that I was the pilot that flew the Chinese to Tehran. Now, the reason I bring this up is that Chiang Kai-shek was a puppet. We all knew that. He was a dictator. He was a puppet of T.V. Sung, the wealthiest man in the world in 1943 at the peak of World War II. And T.V. Sung's sister was Mei Ling Sung, and she was the wife of Chiang Kai-shek. She attended these conferences, these four power conferences. This T.V. Sung's sister attended. Now, let's translate that back. What kind of a power structure does that give somebody like that, or that led a man like Churchill himself later on to refer to a high cabal? Now, if Churchill wasn't the high cabal, what's he talking about? Well, when you begin to define those organizations and many others that we could go ahead with, you see, your question is not far off the mark. It's just a question of what you want to call this organization or these organizations, many of them, that among themselves run the world anonymously and from a position of absolute power.
Bill, you are certainly welcome to call back another evening. We'll get into some of these other subjects at a different time, and I know you're interested in masonry and some of the other subjects, and we'll be glad to put on some programs and get into that for you.
I only mention it because it is such a common thread in all these situations.
Well, there is a common thread, and we'll begin to tie them together for you.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks so much.
Thanks.
For calling.
Bye-bye.
Well, now, let me give our telephone numbers again. It's 464-8295, and let me remind you that you're listening to Radio Liberty here on KFER FM 89.9 on your radio dial. And let's go once again to the telephones here. We have John from Carolinas. John?
Good evening, Stan.
How are you?
Real good. You're coming in loud and clear.
Hey, well, that's great. You know, we just don't know where we're heard, but appreciate your calling so much. Did you have a question for the Colonel?
I would like the Colonel to, if he can, to comment on some of the cover-up after Kennedy's assassination. Specifically, I'm very interested in the autopsy on Kennedy, the discrepancy between the reports from Drs. Boswell and Hume and the reports from the Parkland doctors and some of the real differences in the description of the wounds. I'm also curious about I seem to remember some of the congressional hearings. This is kind of the second part of the question. And I forget if it was Boswell or Hume. One of them said that after they had been questioned by the congressional hearing in the 70s, they walked out of the hearing room and they said they didn't ask the right question. Any comment on that, Colonel?
this business of the cover story, which includes, of course, the autopsy, not only the one gunman and the three bullets, but the autopsy situation, it is a part of the whole thing. It's a major part. People can research this business of the autopsy, as they've done from dawn till midnight for years, and all you learn is that it was not a normal autopsy, it was not a legal autopsy, they should never have removed the body from Texas, law requires that a trial be held whenever there's a murder in the state where there was a murder. Each step of the way, the magazine of the American Medical Association recently published reports from two of their men. They brought two of their people in and had them tell their little stories all over again about the autopsy and all that sort of thing. What is it that forces, that requires a reputable organization such as the American Medical Association and its fine publication to take time off to repeat the mythology set in motion by the Warren Commission and the established cover story of the death of Kennedy? It is not that complex. My God, bullets don't turn circles, guns don't shoot through trees, etc., etc. And once you decide that, the rest of it, all of us know, is cover story, not truth. It's contrived, and it is forced upon us now for 30 years. It's time we stood up and said, no, we're not going to listen to anything anymore. Autopsy, flying bullets, and all the rest of it.
You know, I think one of the most interesting things that I've seen in the last year was the massive attack on Oliver Stone. I mean, everybody attacked him. The right attacked him. The left attacked him. All of the establishment newspapers and television. I didn't see one good word about the movie anyplace. And yet, I thought it was a phenomenal movie. And you could see that the audience was gripped by this. It had an intense emotional appeal. People knew that they were seeing the truth. And yet, you know, when they got out of the theater and suddenly they see all these attacks, pretty soon you say, well, how could it be true when everybody's attacking it?
You know, Stanley, the way you put that is very important. I was on a platform at a major university with a panel, and a panel of experts. And one of them was not an expert on the Kennedy assassination, but he was assistant editor of one of the largest newspapers in the United States. And the dean of the university had just started the question period going, and some student got up and asked about the movie and all that. And immediately this editor, who had a microphone right in front of him, said, the main trouble with the movie is that it is untrue. Well, I had a microphone, and I was sitting right beside this editor. And I said, Mr. Smith, I said, you name any subject that was covered by the movie that is untrue, and I'll talk with you about it right here on this platform now. He never said another word that night, as about 1,000 students clapped as hard as they could clap. See, their stories won't hold. They say these words, but when they publish their newspapers, you don't have a microphone that you can call back to him and say, fellas, your newspaper's all wrong, like I could do when he's sitting beside me on the platform.
And I think another interesting thing is I know that you've been going on small radio stations all across the country telling your story. I suspect that you haven't been on Donahue yet, though. But the average person who's in our listening audience tonight probably has never heard of you before, nor heard of your books, nor heard your story, and most people don't even believe there was a colonel, not necessarily sat on the park bench, but who actually communicated with Garrison and gave him information about the background of the assassination.
Well, I must confirm that I appeared on Good Morning America and on Entertainment Tonight, and I was treated very, very honestly. In other words, it was a fair program on each one. I was on Larry King's show, not the TV, the talk show at night, and I was on with Bohannon instead of King. And again, he's a good rough interrogator, but honest, and we had a good program. So I'm not covering everybody there with the same paintbrush. It's just that where they are closest to the power centers, they cannot change. They have no privilege of changing the cover story.
Well, thank goodness we do have a few places we can get the truth out. John, did you have any other comment for the Colonel?
I was wondering if the Colonel's familiar with, I forget the title of the book and the author, but it was one of the Parkland doctors who recently published a book, and if the Colonel is familiar with that and what he thinks of it.
Say that again, the book was what?
It was written by one of the doctors who was at the Parkland hospital.
Crenshaw.
Yes.
What do you think of the book?
Well, you know, I won't read things like that because the autopsy, although it is very important, and what the doctors did is very important, is not going to solve our problem because we already know that three bullets by themselves from this one gunman from a sixth floor didn't do it. We already know it's physically impossible by the story they've told us. So all the rest of it is just more of the same incorrect work. Unfortunately, the doctors worked under terrible stress. People were ordering them to do things that they ordinarily don't have to do. And a very competent person, Cyril Weck, you probably know Dr. Cyril Weck, who was the head of the National Society in his work, has already explained all these things to anybody that was listening. He's a real famous, honorable man. And then along comes a fellow some 30 years later and says, well, I want to change my story and tell you this. I wish him well, but it doesn't help things the way Stone helped it by hitting it right on the nose.
All right, fine. Well, thanks so much for calling, John, and look forward to hearing from you again.
Oh, I'm sure you will.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Let's see. Let me give you our telephone numbers. Again, it's 464-8295. And on line one we have... Let's see who we have. Actually, my producer is letting me down. Who do we have on line one here? Hello? Hello?
Hello?
Hello. Who do we have?
Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, this is...
Well, do you have a question for the Colonel?
No, I don't. I'm sorry.
All right. I guess we'll just have to let you off the line here then.
Okay, thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, I don't know what that was. So I guess you must have really intimidated that young lady. Let's give our telephone numbers again. Here it's 464-8295. That's 464-8295 if you'd like to talk to the Colonel or ask him any questions at all. And we're going to take a break here for just a minute, if we can. And Colonel, can you stay with us a few minutes more?
Sure.
All right, fine.
American dream has become a nightmare. Signs of the time of cardboard pop corners in town. There's a cancer called crime in our city, and an unspoken fear. We're on our way down.
Well, here we are back on KFER 89.9 FM on your radio dial. And our guest this evening is Colonel Fletcher Prouty, who was a consultant for Oliver Stone's film, JFK. Colonel, have you come into much in the way of criticism or opposition to your telling the story as you've told it this evening?
Oh, well, there's no question about that. And in case you haven't noted it, there is a marvelous paperback book out called JFK, The Story of the Film, written by Oliver Stone. The unusual thing is that it contains every word spoken by the actors during the movie, and every time there is a what we would call contentious point, he has inserted notes, and they are the most marvelous compendium of notes I have seen on this subject. And then the latter half of the book is entitled The Debate. And in The Debate, it's all these articles written by major writers and things on major commentators with TV against Oliver Stone, against me, against Galison, and people like that. I have never seen a book so even-handedly portray a very important event in our history. And if you read that, that'll answer your question. We really took a beating because, you know, we don't have the ability to respond to these fellows at the New York Times and the Washington Post and the LA Times. They can write what they want, and they don't open the door to us. But they did let some letters get published, and on that basis, we had a pretty good little battle going there.
All right, fine. Well, let's take Ben from Santa Cruz. Ben, are you there?
Yeah, it's me again.
Okay.
I got one more question.
All right, fine.
This is in regards to the actual shooting of President Kennedy in the car, and I got a hold of a video from a guy named Bill Cooper who supposedly picked up a copy of a video made of the Zapruder film before it was cut, you know, before they had edited it out, and it shows the driver turning around and finishing off the president with a kill shot to the head, is how they worded it. Word for word, right out of the movie. And I don't know. What's the Colonel think about that? Is that a fact, or is that possible?
Yeah, I've heard of that now for the last two or three years. You know, Cooper is notorious for coming up with very interesting things from time to time, all the way from UFOs to what have you. When I first came into the Army in 41, 42, I did a lot of training of soldiers and officers on firing weapons. And one of the things you have to do when you fire a weapon is aim it. And this situation that Cooper describes of this guy holding some kind of a weapon over his shoulder, his right shoulder, and with his left hand while he's supposed to be driving a car, doesn't give him any opportunity to aim the thing, among other things. I think it's pure fantasy.
And probably Jackie might have noticed that, and you know, the Secret Service people that were on the side of the car probably would have noticed it, you know.
Connolly was right there.
Yeah,
he was in a jump seat right within arm's reach of the man, which people seem to ignore that.
Well, you know, the tragedy is there is all this intentional confusion, and what you have to understand is that they're funneling so many impulses into your mind that you can't think clearly. Forget about all the side issues. Somebody wanted him killed. Who did it and why? And I think that Colonel Prouty answers many of those in his very excellent book, and I'd commend it highly to you, Ben.
I got one more question.
All right, fine. You got one more question. Let me just quickly give our telephone numbers here first. It's 464-8295. 464-8295. We just have one line still open. So go ahead, Ben. Last question.
All right. In the last couple of years, they've been arresting these computer hackers, and one in particular, Kevin Mitnick. I guess he broke into a network called DocMaker or DocMaster, and he downloaded some files regarding this type of stuff, this covert stuff, and that's one of the reasons they went after him. Have you heard anything about that? And especially, I don't know, just what's your comment on that?
Well, you know, just talking about people breaking into this covert files, computer hackers, he wondered if you'd heard about somebody being arrested for breaking into some of the CIA's secret files.
Files on the
assassination
stuff.
Stanley, if the American public knew how thoroughly bugged every one of us is and how easy it is and how much it happens, especially against the business world, we would know that such stories really are just barely putting your toe in the water. this business of the spread of the gaining of secret intelligence through communication intercept and things like that is one of the biggest businesses there is today, and it is, I understand that at least 85% of the international business traffic, ordinary business traffic, is intercepted every day and read out by computers to the point where the messages that they want, the hot ones, are transcribed almost in real time. It's unbelievable. In my day, back in the 50s, I remember going downtown in Washington to what they called the main switches,